Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Thank you for joining me today. It's a great Sunday afternoon, Palm Sunday. 1 week until Easter. I'm with you every Sunday, 3 to 5, on the show called Stand to Reason. And that's what we do. We don't always stand. Sometimes we sit, like now. But we are standing, figuratively speaking, and reasoning for the most important issues of life, ethics, values, and religion. And we do so all the time, but here on the public airwaves of talk radio on Sundays, 3 to 5, Los Angeles time. I say that in case some of you are still downloading our radio show and listening through our webcast, or rather our podcast. If you wanted to call in, you can do so during our live show at 1-800-227-5278. Of course, that's the number for everyone. So if you're listening now live, you can ring me up at that number, 1-800-227-5278. People are already doing it, I can see. And if you're local to me in the 714 area code here in Southern California, 754-4150 is the number. The big news item this week is the Gospel of Judas. And LA Times on Friday has a front page story about it. I actually was in the bookstore on Thursday and just walking around in a Borders and looking for the table in which all of the books dealing with the ancient documents, something similar to the Da Vinci Code, which I just finished yesterday, by the way. I finished the entire novel. I had already read through the salient details that had to do with the challenge that Dan Brown makes in his book on the classical understanding of Christianity and its historical documents. I mean, I'd already done that because I've written on that, and I needed to do that work first, reading the book. And that piece that I've written, by the way, will be available May 1st. We'll be sending it out, a double issue of Solid Ground, our bi-monthly newsletter dealing with the Da Vinci Code. Is called The Da Vinci Code Cracks, and I give my response for you, our constituency, and in kind of, I think, our unique Stand to Reason way, thinking through it in a way a little bit different, I think, than the way others have approached it. But I think you will find this to be very useful and helpful, because not only do I try to undermine the absolutely spurious claims that Dan Brown makes in his book with regards to the textual tradition, the gospel tradition, if you will, that undergirds our understanding of Christ. But in so doing, we then are able to highlight the strongest part of our case, and that's the historical soundness of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and why we have good reason to believe that they are the most authentic accounts and accurate accounts of the life of Jesus of Nazareth. Now, of course, you have all kinds of books that are coming out, and I was looking at the table to see this just an explosion of titles that are coming out dealing with things like this. You know, Christians, you've been tricked by someone. The bogeyman usually is the Roman Catholic Church, but they've tricked you for thousands of years, and the real truth is coming out, and we have it, and here it is. Now, it turns out that theme is being played by lots of people. I actually saw a quote from Irwin McManus, who is the pastor of a church here, I think it's in the Los Angeles area, called Mosaic, which is more of an emergent church. And the quote said something like, it was on his website, I think. The quote said something like, we are going to, the biggest threat to the teachings of Jesus is Christianity. Something like that. I should have written it down, but that's pretty close. Now, this guy's a pastor of a church, right? But it's an emerging church. It's following this new tradition. And this is a theme that they often say. The biggest threat to Jesus and the real gospel and the real truth and the real teaching is Christianity. In other words, those who are kind of holding the central position right now, those in power right now representing Christianity, evangelicals in particular, the churched. And so there is this theme, whether it's coming from Dan Brown or Irwin McManus, that or the LDS, the Mormons, that what we have now and we think is the real thing is really just a perversion, and someone else is going to show you the real McCoy that's been hidden from you, the real Christianity. And what's interesting is it's that theme that plays over and over. You've been duped. We have the real thing. But the real thing that's offered is variously the emerging church, the Mormon church, or Dan Brown and the Priory of Sion and the whole Mary Magdalene trip. I mean, the answers, the things that people say are the real McCoy, are wildly divergent from each other. But this theme is very popular. And the latest player right now is the Gospel of Judas. This is a document that comes from, I think, the Nag Hammadi Library, or at least it came from Egypt, and was just recently deciphered after a fashion, and not really deciphered. I mean, it was in Coptic, which is an Egyptian language, ancient language, and it was a codex. That means it was in a book form with a couple of other works, for example, the first apocalypse of James, a letter of Peter to Philip, the book of Elogenes. These are all ancient texts that were bound together with this Gospel of Judas. And the Gospel itself isn't really that long. I should say the so-called Gospel. This one dates through paleographical methods, that is, they look at the writing style and the paper, the parchment and the ink and things like that. They dated it about 300, which would be, you know, almost 250 years, a little more than 250 years after the events in question. And it is signed by Judas. That is, Judas's name is on it as the author, and this would be Judas, the one who allegedly, according to the canonical Gospels, betray Christ. Now, this is a significant find of archaeology. It is not a lost book of the Bible, but it is a significant find of archaeology. Now, there's a difference between the two. If you go to our website at str.org, there's a piece I've written called No Lost Books, which I revisit, an idea which I revisit in the upcoming treatment of the Da Vinci Code entitled The Da Vinci Code Cracks, which you'll get in the mail if you receive Solid Ground. If you don't receive it, by the way, you can just call 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, and tell them you want to receive Solid Ground. We'll mail it to you. And or you can go to our website at str.org and sign up there. In any event, this is a document that is an account of the life of Christ. Now, let me just mention a mistake that people often make when it comes to these kinds of finds. I mentioned that it was a significant archaeological find. It isn't as if no one knew about this book. We did know it existed because early church fathers, specifically Irenaeus in the second century, wrote about this book and many others. It was in a group of books that were known as the Pseudepigrapha. Now, if you know something about word roots, you know that pseudo means false, and pigrapha or grapha means right. So a pseudepigrapha were false writings, that is, spurious works that represented themselves as accounts of the life of Jesus, which the early church fathers knew were phonies, and therefore they listed them as such and rejected them. Later on, even destroyed them. But anyway, this came up on a list by the early church father, Eusebius, who fought Gnosticism. That is, when I say fought, he didn't take up arms. He argued against it. I have his writings, and where he writes extensively against a point of view called Gnosticism. Now, Gnosticism is a second century religious view that hitchhikes on Christian terms and Christian persona, like Jesus himself, but gives a completely different characterization. This isn't just a modification like between Presbyterians and Baptists. This is a different world. This is a whole different religion. It wasn't there in the first century, but there was a seminal form of it. It wasn't until the second century it took a full-blown full-blown religious characteristics as a competitor for Christianity. Now, the early church fathers warned of these. Irenaeus, by the way, was a disciple of Polycarp, who is a disciple of the Apostle John. So Irenaeus is fairly close to the apostolic witness, and he in his writings gives what would be considered an orthodox understanding of Jesus. That is, he's arguing against Gnostics who are now rising up, all offering a different view and a different Jesus. I can't go into all the details of Gnosticism. It's actually very complex and confusing, but you don't need to know the details to know that it arose in the second century as a competitor to Christianity. Now, since it was a competitor, and people like Irenaeus quoted regularly from the four Gospels, and as did the other fathers, and the very earliest lists of biblical documents identified the four canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, as legitimate characterizations of the life of Christ. You can understand how these people like Irenaeus, who was an apologist, a defender of the faith, now must stand up against false teaching that's attacking historical Christianity. And he does this in a polemic, that is, in a debate that he puts in writing. You can read it. It's in the Ante-Nicene Fathers, five or six volumes of writings of those church fathers that came before Nicaea. In fact, you can find it on the internet, earlychristianwritings.com, I think it is, or maybe .org, but they're easy to find. And they're in the public domain, so you can read all of these things that these guys wrote, and they condemned this book as a phony. That's why we know it existed, but we didn't have a copy. Now they've unearthed a copy that apparently was shuffled around by traders who tried initially to get $3 million for it. I don't think they got that for it, but it sat in a safety deposit box in New York City, I think, for 20 years or something like that. And therefore, it was almost in unreadable condition. It was falling apart. And the National Geographic Society, which helped with the efforts to save the manuscript, actually did a marvelous job, I guess, in preserving it and making it available. And now there's a translation. In fact, I saw the translation of this gospel in the bookstore the other day, along with another book that is the full story of how they rescued this document. By the way, those of you who are fans of the Da Vinci Code, according to the Da Vinci Code, there are cases of what's called sangreal documents from the first century, which includes Mary Magdalene's writings and writings from Jesus and the infamous Q document. And a bunch of other things. I mean, there's two big boxes, massive boxes full of these things that really show the truth over and against the canonical Gospels and the church's version about what happened with Jesus. You see what happened to this Gospel of Judas that lasted for 1,900 years in the desert sands when it was removed from that protected environment, that dry environment, when it sat just for 20 years in a safety deposit box in New York City, it almost turned to dust. Can you imagine what documents would be like if they're carted around a bunch of coffin-like things for 2,000 years, as Dan Brown suggests with these other documents? They would be dust. They would never survive that, just to underscore the fact that he's writing fiction. I just want to make a comment about this. I haven't actually researched the Gospel of Judas very thoroughly, but I want to make some observations about this that are important, okay? The mistake a lot of people make is to think that if an ancient text is found entitled Gospel of Judas, for example, then Jesus' disciple Judas must have written it. And many people are apparently unaware that there were dozens of pseudepigrapha, these false documents circulating in the early centuries. These aren't surprises. It's neat that we found this, in a sense, from an archaeological perspective, but we knew it existed at some time, along with the Gospel of Thomas and many others that were written of as spurious at the time. Many of them destroyed, and then a whole cache of them found in Nag Hammadi, Egypt in 1945. That's why we have copies of the Gospel of Thomas, for example, now. So these things have surfaced in modern times, but we've known about them because the old guys wrote about them and warned us against them. So there were dozens of pseudepigrapha, false writings that were circulating in the early centuries, and the imposters gave them titles like the ones they did, like Gospel of Philip and Gospel of Mary Magdalene and Gospel of Judas. Why would they do that? Because they wanted people to consider them authentic. They're not going to name their gospel that they're writing 200 years after the fact or 150 years after the fact. They're not going to name it the Gospel of Fred. Because who's Fred? He's nobody. They're going to name it after somebody famous to give it credibility. The problem is you already had other gospels circulating for a long time that were accepted by the church fathers having come from reliable authorities. And when matched together, it was clear that these other gospels represented a whole different religious viewpoint, these representing Gnosticism. And this is why they were rejected by the fathers. This isn't rocket science. Now, what you can't do is you can't just pick up any old piece of parchment out of the sand and then trust it as if this is the real McCoy. Certain questions need to be asked, like who wrote it? And it's not enough just to see whose name is at the bottom. But who wrote it? If the document says Paul to the Corinthians, that doesn't mean that Paul wrote it. We have to have some reasons to believe that this is authentic. The same kind of questions, by the way, are asked of the biblical documents. Who wrote it? When did they write it? If this was written in 150, which is the claim apparently, this document is 300, it was a copy in Coptic. It was a translation of the Greek original, which copy was from the 3rd century, and the original allegedly was from the middle 1st century. So it was over 125 years from the time of the events. 125 years from the time of the events. Let me say it again. It was written 125 years from the time of the events. Now let's just, at a wild guess, do you think maybe the Judas that was a companion to Jesus, who betrayed him allegedly, was at least 20 years old? If he was at least 20 years old in 33 AD, and 125 years later the Gospel of Judas was written, then either Judas, who didn't hang himself, was 145 years old when he wrote the Gospel of Judas, or someone, not Judas, wrote it. This is not an eyewitness account. This isn't from Judas. Somebody wrote it and put Judas's name on it. Who wrote it? When did they write it? Has there been any corruption since the original writing? This is why you have to have a lot of manuscripts to compare to see if anything's changed since the original. We have that with the New Testament. There's only one copy of this. That's called the manuscript evidence. And even if it's authentic, can we trust the material? Okay, some have said, well, this is an authentic Gospel of Judas, but keep in mind what they mean by that. That means it's a real example, an authentic copy of the work from antiquity called the Gospel of Judas. They are not saying that it's an authentic gospel written by Judas. The question is whether the Gospel of Judas itself is authentic, or is it a true, what we have now, a true, authentic copy of a spurious work? And you see, it takes more scholarship to figure that out. Now, at best, what you have is a group of documents in competition. You have the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Judas now, and others, who the early church fathers called false writings and listed them as spurious. And you have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Now, which one should we trust? When we come back, I'm going to tell you why, very simply, we should trust Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as being early and authentic, and not these other so-called Gospels of the life of Christ. I'm Greg Kokel. The show is Stand to Reason. Stay with us. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, well, I've got great news for you. After more than a year in development, the brand new Stand to Reason interactive training series on tactics in defending the faith is now available on DVD. Included are 6 one-hour sessions where I train you step-by-step in valuable, easy-to-use, time-tested techniques that keep you in the driver's seat when talking with others. It's perfect for home groups, for Sunday school, for Bible studies, for homeschooling, with interactive discussion questions, role-playing, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, and a leader guide and a 100-page comprehensive workbook that you can reproduce for each member of your group. Now, if you learn best by listening, mentoring CDs are available, but the best combination is to get them both. Then you'll have the DVD training course, the mentoring CDs to listen to in the car or on your iPod, and the comprehensive 100-page workbook. Now, the special pre-order price through the end of the month is $39.95. After that, it'll be $50. So order now. The Tactics DVDs will ship by the end of the month. Go to our website at str.org or call us at 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. Don't delay. str.org or 1-800-2-REASON. Stand to Reason has an absolutely unique cruise conference experience for you this fall. Hi, I'm Greg Kokel, and on September 16th, we'll set sail from Boston with Holland American Cruise Line. We'll enjoy the scenery of the New England coastline, the Canadian Maritimes, the St. Lawrence Seaway, Quebec, and Montreal. In addition to the scenery, you'll enjoy the fellowship of other like-minded Christians and a conference program designed for those who want to represent Christ to a world looking for answers to life's toughest questions. And I'll be joined by some very distinguished guest speakers, Dr. J. Wesley Richards from the Acton Institute, national radio talk show host Kirby Anderson from Probe Ministries, and Kurt Swindoll of Cool Strategies, who will MC all of our events. Our plan is to stimulate you with challenging presentations, answer your questions in open forum discussions, and enrich you through interaction and fellowship, all against the backdrop of New England and the Canadian Maritimes in the fall. Come join Stand to Reason and our all-star lineup for a memorable spiritual adventure. Space on board is limited, so get the details from 1-800-2-REASON or visit str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org. I look forward to seeing you on board. Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. And, of course, big issue this week is the so-called Gospel of Judas. I say so-called because people get the opinion that, are of the opinion that if it just simply says the gospel of someone, that it must be a bona fide account of the life of Christ. But, of course, we know that not all gospels are. Because there are a number of Gospels that give wildly disparate accounts of the life of Christ. We have the canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. In fact, some people will say even those are wildly disparate, especially Matthew, Mark, Luke, which are called the synoptic Gospels because they are synoptic. They have the same look or the same eye or the same view. And as opposed to the Gospel of John, it simply means that Gospel of John explores a lot of new territory that the other three don't. They're very similar. John is different, but we see differences there that people, I think, sometimes overplay. But certainly we have the famous Gospel of Thomas that was discovered last century, though we knew it existed because of earlier references to it by early church fathers, as a spurious gospel or an account of the Gnostic view of Christ. That would be G-N-O-S-T-I-C. Gnosticism was a very aggressive religious point of view in the second century that was written against and combated aggressively, polemically, that is, in arguments by the early church fathers, principally Irenaeus. And you can read about that in his own writings if you have a copy of the writings of the anti-Nicene fathers, or you can just simply Google Irenaeus, I-R-E-N-A-E-S, I think it is. And you'll find it because this is in the public domain, all his writings. But they talked about these other Gnostic Gospels as spurious. If they are not, then the canonical Gospels are. So it's clear that not all things that are called Gospels are, in fact, accurate characterizations of the life of Christ. So what are we to make of Judas? That is the Gospel of Judas, this one now just released. One document of Judas, a long-lost gospel, if you will, ancient document, then it's just been published. National Geographic Society, I think, is doing a special on it tonight at 8 o'clock or whenever it is whenever National Geographic does its thing on these things in your neighborhood. I think in L.A. it's 8 o'clock. We'll be talking about this. So what do we make of it? Well, this copy is a Coptic translation of the original Greek. This one goes back to 300, the original apparently about 140, which means it's over 100 years after the time of Christ. So that means if that's when this is written, this couldn't be the Gospel of Judas. not the man Judas, who would have been long dead. This is true of many documents that were produced during that time and were identified immediately as spurious by the Christians who had authentic accounts of Jesus' life in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And I have an argument for this, and I just want you to consider it. And you don't have to be a specialist in this area to understand this argument. It's pretty straightforward. Just a simple observation. Full-blown Gnosticism is largely a second-century phenomena. Christianity, as we know it, is a first, or Christianity started in the first century. Let's put it that way, obviously, around 33 AD. But Gnosticism was a full-blown religious teaching in the second century, which those who are closely related to the apostolic witness, Irenaeus, a disciple of Polycarp, a disciple of John, the apostle, opposed aggressively as a false understanding of the person of Jesus. These were very different views, the Gnostic view and the view of Irenaeus and the other church fathers who were arguing in defense of what they understood Christianity to be. So we have a Christianity in the first century, then we have Gnosticism, which is a second century phenomena. We have Gnostic Gospels that are also second century phenomena. When you look at the characterization of Philip and Mary Magdalene and even here Judas and Thomas, these other alleged Gospels, scholars put them mid-second century or maybe early second century, but the time of their writing is a long time after the time of Jesus. Now, some people want to do the same thing with the canonical Gospels. There are problems with that, though. There are very strong arguments that put all of the canonical Gospels in the first century and, in fact, before 70 AD, one of the strongest being that in 70 AD the temple was destroyed. And if these documents, which were viewed by some as anti-Semitic, were written after the Jewish temple and, in fact, the nation of Israel was destroyed by the Romans, then those Gospels written after the fact would have included, it seems to me, that fact, the destruction of Jerusalem, to make a theological point that the Christians were right and the Jews were wrong. None of the Gospels include that, though they do have the prophecy of the destruction of the temple, Matthew 24, Luke 21 in particular. Now, if Luke, whoever wrote the Gospel of Luke, put those words into Jesus' mouth, you would think that he would also put the prophecy fulfillment in his same book if, in fact, he was writing after 70. It doesn't appear that he was writing after 70. Part of the reason we know that is because there was another book he wrote after he wrote, whoever this person that we call Luke is, that person also wrote the book of Acts, and this is uncontested. The book of Acts ends with Paul's first Roman imprisonment, which is approximately 62. Now, Paul didn't survive the decade. He was executed under the Neronian persecution sometime mid-60s, maybe 64, maybe 65, maybe 66, but he was sure dead by then. But when Luke stops his account in the book of Acts, it stops abruptly with Paul in Rome. Now, why do you think that was? Because probably that's when Luke finished writing the book of Acts and there was nothing more to write. Luke was apparently with Paul at the time. You see the we sections that are mentioned. We did this, we did that, and then we this and that and the other thing, and there he is with Paul. And he stops writing at Paul's first Roman imprisonment somewhere around 62, maybe 63, maybe 61. But early. And the Gospel of Luke had to be written before that, and nobody thinks that Luke is the first Gospel. Mark and Matthew both vie for that honor, which puts Mark and Matthew before Luke, and Luke before Acts, and Acts before 62 AD. Do you see the line of thinking here? We've got three Gospels by the end of the 60s. Inside of 30 years of the life of Jesus Christ. So we have Gnostic Gospels in the second century. We have canonical Gospels in the first century. Why would anyone think that Gnosticism is more primitive a form of Christianity than that which the canonical Gospels demonstrate. Further, we have all the writings of Paul, which have a very high Christology. And these are not contested, at least the main ones are not contested. That Paul wrote Romans is not contested by anyone. He had to write that before 60, sometime in the 50s, and it has a high Christology. Jesus is the Son of God raising from the dead. He's got the Orthodox picture of Jesus. So we have a strong Orthodox witness early on and a strong unorthodox witness later on. Which do you think is the most primitive? This is not that difficult when you think of it that way. Well, we got our lines, wow, absolutely full. Every line is full, so let's go to the callers. And we have our first caller, Jeff, calling from Singapore. Welcome to Stand to Reason, Jeff.
Hey, Greg. Good to talk to you.
That is the cleanest city in the world.
It is.
I was there a couple of times, and it's immaculate, the whole thing. You won't even find a piece of gum on the sidewalk, will you?
Nope. It's the streets are clean. It helps not having snow or anything like that.
Yeah, I think it's against the law to spit or something, like you get thrown in jail if you drop gum. Maybe that's a little extreme. But anyway, glad to hear from you from Singapore. What's on your mind, Jeff?
Question about – I'm going to kind of blend my question between archaeology and theology.
Okay.
But every once in a while I'm watching History Channel, and there's a show on about the Ark of the Covenant.
Mm-hmm.
Where is the Ark? And we'll probably see a few of these shows here coming up on Easter. But a lot of these shows, they all tend to agree on a few points, that Hezekiah's reign was probably the last time that the Ark was mentioned in Scripture.
Right, and that was like 400 years before the time of Christ, or actually 550 or something like that, 500 years roughly, right?
Right.
Maybe even before that, Hezekiah, yeah. Well, go ahead.
And they don't mention... They don't mention the Ark during the Babylonian exile return.
Right.
And then later you have the Arch of Titus over in Rome,
mm-hmm.
showing, commemorating the 70 AD destruction of Jerusalem, and show the temple menorah and the showbread table and some trumpets being hauled back to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And so it got me to wondering about the temple curtain being torn when Jesus was crucified.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first things that happens after he finally gives up his spirit, symbolizing that man now can come directly to God.
Correct, Christ. Yeah.
But it started to occur to me, do most scholars agree that, or just assume that when the temple curtain was torn that the Ark was there? Or did the temple curtain get torn and there's nothing back there?
Well, I'm not sure how to answer that question. There was an original Ark that had the that was built early on. We read about that, and I think during the time of Hezekiah, that's when it disappeared. There was, if you recall from the account in Daniel, where the handwritings on the wall, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin, part of what stimulated that is the ruler at that time. I can't remember his name, but he was kind of mocking Israel, and he was taking the things they had stolen from the temple, and they were getting drunk with them, drinking out of them and all that other stuff, this holy, the holy dishes, as it were. And this brought judgment upon them. So we know that things were taken out of the temple. I don't know that they were returned, and although they might have been, and it's just, this is one of those things that has kind of drifted into just into ignorance. What the heck happened to that thing? It just kind of disappeared. Maybe it doesn't exist. Maybe it does exist somewhere. But I have no reason to believe, and I'm not an expert in this, and somebody else might be better off to speak on this. But my understanding is that the Ark of the Covenant was gone by then, the bona fide Ark of the Covenant. The Shekinah glory had left already. And Jeremiah talks about this, I think, either Jeremiah or Ezekiel. I think it's Jeremiah. The Shekinah glory, the presence of God, left the temple and then lingered in the east gate and then left for good. And it's been gone ever since, because at that point was the time of the Gentiles. That's when the Babylonian captivity came and the Jews were carried off. And since then, it's pretty much been the Gentiles ruling and not the Jews. Even when the Jews returned, they were under the heel of the Gentiles. So when you have the time of Christ, you have a new temple being built. You have Herod's temple. It's going to be built largely according to the past pattern. So you're going to have similar kind of features there, including the Holy of Holies. Now, what do you do when you have a Holy of Holies and a curtain there, and the curtain would have to have been remade, by the way. This would have been a newer curtain. When there's no there's no Ark of the Covenant with the cherubim and the place where the mercy seat and all of that. My suspicion is, and this is just my guess, I'm pretty confident there was no Shekinah glory there. There was no presence of God there. However, my suspicion is that they just rebuilt the instruments just like they rebuilt the temple so that they would have the things necessary to do the job they were doing. And remember when John the Baptist's birth was prophesied, Zechariah, his father, was doing service inside the Holy of Holies when he saw an angel and got the prophecy about John. So they were still in the process of doing the standard things there, and you would need to have a Ark of the Covenant, a mercy seat, the cherubim, the whole deal in order to carry out the particulars of the sacrifices that were required. And so my suspicion is that they made another one, but the second one certainly wasn't like the first one because it was never invested with the Shekinah glory, the visible presence of God among his people, and therefore it just didn't have the same significance. What happened to that one? Who knows? It would probably be taken out when the Romans attacked in 70.
Right.
So, but this is speculative, although I think what I've offered you, but I think that virtually anything is going to be speculative on that issue because so little is known about what happened to that artifact.
Right. I asked the question because it seemed like if there was nothing back there, then maybe the symbolism of the temple curtain being torn is kind of lost on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, then there'd be nothing for them to do. And clearly they were doing things. Zechariah is an example. So there must have been, well, even the curtain. You know, look, if the original temple is destroyed Nebuchadnezzar, then the whole thing's gone, which includes the curtain. So if they have a curtain now at the time of Jesus, it's got to be a new curtain. So I suspect they not only made the new curtain, they made everything that went behind the new curtain so that they could do what they needed to do. They rebuilt the temple and rebuilt the instruments that they were to use in the cult of worship there according to God's specifications in the Pentateuch. That would be my guess, but it is only a guess.
So even with God's Shekinah glory gone, Jesus still got pretty worked up about the selling of the money changers there, though.
Well, that's right, because it was in the court of the Gentiles, and remember what's going on there. They were money changers. You know when you go into the airport and you see cambio, change? That means you change money from one type of currency into another. And what was going on there is that people who came, in this case Gentiles from other countries, to pay their due honor to the God of Israel, though they were not Jews themselves, they were God-fearers, they were outsiders who were allowed to participate at a very limited level, they still needed to do business with the temple in the currency of the country. And so they brought their currency in and changed money there so they would have the currency of the country to do business with, but they were being ripped off through exorbitant rates of exchange. And so here is the Gentiles have an opportunity to come in and to worship the God of Israel. And what is Israel, who is supposed to be a light to the nations, doing? They're stealing from them. They're taking advantage of them. And that's what made Jesus so angry. And certainly the temple was an important part. Even if the Shekinah glory wasn't there, it was still important. And Jesus did his due diligence, you know, in terms of keeping the laws and doing what he was supposed to do in the temple. But I think that, yeah, all of the original curtain and particulars that were part of the furniture, if you will, of the temple were long gone. That's my sense of it. All righty, Jeff?
That's great.
Okay, have a good time. It must be nighttime there in Singapore, huh?
It's 6 in the morning.
Okay. Well, you have a good day, Jeff. And thanks for your call. 1-800-227-5278. Greg Kokel for Standard Reason.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. If you're tired of finding yourself flat...
Glory, 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 to God be the glory, great things he hath done.
Greg Kokel back with you here, giving you a piece of my mind today. I started out with talking about the Gospel of Judas, and if you haven't, if you're just tuning in now, then you need to download our show at str.org and get the details. It's very important. Many of you are listening now on not only on live streaming at www.kbrt740.com. I think our last caller was live streaming from Singapore at 6 in the morning there. But many of you are, of course, taking advantage of our podcast. We would love to know where you guys are located. We've been doing radio a long time now, but it's getting to the point now with podcasting and internet. You know, we don't know where our listeners are. They used to be just Southern California, but now they're all over the world. And we've got a little way to kind of keep track of you to find out who you are. It's called Frapper, F-R-A-P-P-R. It's a special kind of map where you can stick in a stick pin and indicate where you're at if you're a listener to Stand to Reason. If you listen through streaming or over the regular radio or through our podcast, you can put a stick pin in a map, show us where you're located. Some people even post a photograph and whatever. We've got a couple of hundred now since I mentioned this first last week, and we have them all over the world. I mean, more and more. We've got people in Germany and Iraq and New Zealand and Australia and the United Kingdom. And what we're doing now is if you go ahead and do that, and the simple thing to do is just go to the simplest way to do it is go to our website, find the podcasting page, and then once the podcasting page is up, wait a few seconds and you'll see the map resolve itself there, and then you can go ahead and register and stick a pin in the map wherever in the world that you happen to be. And every week we're going to have a drawing for somebody who's on the map. So not only would we like to find out who you are and where you are, and it's kind of fun for the community of those listening at Stand to Reason, but we'd also like to reward you for your effort by putting you in a drawing and then drawing your names and sending out a free gift, a free book, in this particular case, to you. In fact, we have our first winner just a couple of days ago. We drew from our list, and we pulled up a soldier from Iraq, Joshua Kulser, a soldier in Baghdad from Minnesota. We had 153 total pins as of this morning, and and he was one of them, and so we pulled his name out. We've contacted him, and he sent us a little note, in fact. Here's what he said. We're sending him the book, Relativism. I just signed it for him, so it's on its way. He said, I listen to the weekly podcast, as I'm usually unable to listen live on Sundays. Thank you so much for the book. Please thank Greg as well for – this was sent to Melinda, who had communicated with him. Please thank Greg as well for helping me reasoning with some of the other soldiers. Last night I got into a discussion with one of my sergeants and used the Columbo tactic to have a very intellectual conversation rather than just a yes, the Bible is true argument. He adds here, please pray for all who are deployed that the gospel would be proclaimed to the men and women over here. It's truly a matter of life and death. We never know what conversation will be our last. So thank you, Josh. Glad to have you on board. And folks, you pray for Josh and our other service people over there that are putting their lives on the line. But glad to send you this book. Maybe next week your name will be up. Just go to str.org and go to our podcast and find the map and register, whether you listen through the regular broadcast, whether you listen by delay and podcast, whether you listen through streaming. It doesn't matter. We just want to know where you're at. So go ahead and check it out. str.org, punch the podcast in the at the top on the right-hand side, and just follow the prompts. You can do it. So I'll try to update you on a weekly basis of what's going on there. Let's go back to the phones, and this is David. Welcome to the show, David. Greg Kokel, hi.
Hey, Greg. How are you?
Good. Thanks, Dave.
Hey, terrific. Just real quick, not to get off my subject, but just briefly, you know, I think the I used to think that this Da Vinci Code was quite evil, but actually I think it's quite good.
How so?
Because, well, actually because there's a tremendous famine in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that famine, as you know, is for the word of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And I think Matthew 24 sums it up quite nicely with respect to famines and pestilences. In this country, in the United States, I think the famines and the pestilences are a little bit different than they would be in sub-Saharan Africa.
They're more spiritual. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's a good metaphor for what's going on, I think. And I do think there's a tremendous opportunity. I passed a billboard coming into the studio here today. It said Da Vinci Code movie May 14th or something like that. So
yeah.
The book has sold upwards of 50 million copies, and now the paperback's out, and so it's still moving, and then the movie comes out. It's a great opportunity for Christians to respond. This is one of the reasons I wrote a double issue of Solid Ground coming out in May, mm-hmm. May 1st. And because I think what it's going to do for us, David, is it's going to give us a chance in responding to the Da Vinci Code fiction. We are going to be able to showcase our strongest points for the historical soundness of Christianity. So not only are we rebutting a false claim, but we are also showcasing our strongest claims about why Jesus Christ is who we claim him to be.
Mm-hmm.
I always think that the historical record is really most pivotal, most important for us, as opposed to, you know, the full inspiration of the scriptures. I hold to that, but even if we didn't have scriptures that were fully inspired, as long as we have an historically accurate gospels, we can make the case for Christianity. So,
sure.
And that's what we'll be able to do. Yeah.
Without a doubt. No, I couldn't agree more. So, you know, praise God. A lot of people say this is for evil, but you know what? As Joseph said.
Yeah, God could mean it for good.
Exactly.
And we're going to be there for him. Right. Luke 16.
Yeah, actually, that's exactly what I called about. You know, it's actually Luke 16, 19 through 31.
Uh-huh.
The story of the rich man and Lazarus.
Right.
Many people a lot of times will, and I read this a little bit differently than a lot of people from what I've been told, you know, how they read it. A lot of people I talk to, they describe this as an actual picture of heaven, and I don't necessarily agree with that, because if we look at Luke 16 throughout, the entire chapter deals with stewardship, because there's a couple things that I find it very odd that, for example, right before the story of the rich man and Lazarus, we have verse number 18, which deals with
divorce.
Adultery.
Pardon me?
With adultery.
Yeah, right. Divorce and adultery. Right.
Right. And
it's principally divorce, and whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, is what Jesus says. Right.
Whoever putteth away his wife and marrieth another committeth adultery. And mm-hmm. and I almost feel that is a direct slap at the Pharisees, in the sense that they put away the word, they put away their knowledge of God for the Gentiles, and essentially married another, essentially false god, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we look logically at Luke, you know, the story of the rich.
Yeah, just for people, just to bring people up to speed, this is the account where two men are dead. One is a rich man and one is Lazarus. Lazarus was a believer, rich man not. And so the rich man is in a place of torment, and Lazarus is in a place called Abraham's bosom where he's receiving a comfort. And many people, it's not clear whether this is an account, a description of an actual place, or whether it's a parable of some sort. And so your understanding of the intermediate stage, that is what happens between the time you die and the ultimate reward, if there is such an intermediate stage, it's informed one way or another by this passage. And so this is why it's somewhat controversial, because of what it says about that. You're actually taking it from a different perspective. Is that right?
Well, in the sense that if you look at things the way everything is veiled within the Bible.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true, but
well, in the sense that, for example, the rich man would be the Jewish church or the Jewish the Pharisees and so forth, because they were given stewardship of the word, and they did not share that with the Gentiles the way they should. As a matter of fact, you know, in verse 21, it talks about Lazarus, which laid at the gate, and he was full of sores, and he was desiring to be fed with the crumbs. Now, crumbs would be the scraps of the bread or the word. Am I correct?
Well, you're reading – what you're doing is you're taking this passage and you're allegorizing almost every aspect of it.
That's correct.
And so when it says the rich man, Lazarus is wanting to eat the crumbs under the table, you're saying that the Lazarus was willing – to eat the cast-offs of the Jews, which were the word that the scriptures, that the truth that the Jews weren't willing to not only share with him, but they weren't even really to follow themselves. And so he eats the crumbs, and so you have Jesus. There's another account where a Syrophoenician woman says, you know, even the dogs eat the crumbs under the table or whatever. I don't have a sense. Yeah, I don't have any sense at all that this is what's going on in this passage. And frankly, although I've studied this even in theology class, this passage, that way of understanding it never even came up. So it may be a very unique way of reading it. I think it probably has actually, that section starts out. Now, the Pharisees were lovers of money and were listening to all these things, and they were scoffing at Jesus. And then he said to them, "You justify yourselves in the sight of men, but God knows your hearts, for that which is highly esteemed among men is detestable in the sight of God." And then he talks about the law and the prophet, and he's got these series of things going that are really, and they are clearly indictments of the Jews. You have the unrighteous steward that comes in the beginning of that chapter. You have these things that are blocked together, but I have no reason to metaphorize all the details of this so that Jesus isn't talking about the afterlife. He's not talking about death or torment or anything. He's just simply talking about Jews who won't give the scriptures to the Gentiles. I don't see how to get that from reading this. You know, the Jews aren't going to get this. They don't seem to have responded to it that way. Nobody else seems to get it that way.
No, that's true, though. But then there's another part in the Bible where Jesus prays to the Heavenly Father that he says that I'm glad that you withheld these things from the wise and the prudent and gave them to the ones that were not so wise.
Yeah, understanding. But you gave them to those that were not so wise. I don't know of those not so wise, the believers.
Correct.
That have taken this in this way. It certainly is the case that many of the things that Jesus said weren't obvious to the people, many of the people he was talking to, but later on he explained it in the text to others so we could figure it out. This one seems to be fairly straightforward. There's no indication that they misunderstood it. It seems to me that we should then take this at a straightforward sense. He didn't indicate that this is one of those secret things.
Well, I could appreciate that, except that in verse 30 and 31, Jesus, especially in verse 30 and 31, and he said, "Nay, Father Abraham, but if one went unto them from the dead." Now, Jesus did rise
sure.
from, Right.
Yeah, will they repent? And he said, even if somebody comes back from the dead, they're not going to necessarily listen to him just because of that.
And they didn't, and of course they did not listen to Jesus.
But that's exactly what happened. Jesus came back from the dead. So in other words, this is not a metaphoric statement here. This is rather a straightforward reference to something that a resurrection that in fact took place later. I'm not inclined to metaphorize all of these things the way that you've done. I think then you lose the whole meaning of the passage. If Jesus meant this other thing, boy, it lost on me and a whole bunch of other people then, too. Anyway, good working on it. David, I appreciate your call, and we've got another hour ahead of us, so stay with us on Stand to Reason. All right, friends, hour number two here at Stand to Reason, a tournament of thought in every show. Greg Kokel, your host. This is the place to get a well-furnished mind, and thank you for joining me today. Our second hour, with you every Sunday, is 3 to 5. If you missed the first hour, you missed, I think, a very important discussion by me, soliloquy, I guess, have to call it, about the Gospel of Judas. Go to SDR.org tomorrow and download the show. You can get the MP3 file there. It doesn't cost anything. In fact, that'd be a good time for you to register for podcasting, and we'll ship it right to you on a regular basis. Not only do we have our weekly show podcast, we have our daily podcast now, which are short vignettes, just a few minutes, 3 to 5 minutes, of a thoughtful item that I pass on to you. So you can kind of get a daily dose, like a daily vitamin, of Stand to Reason. You need to sign up for each one individually. So we have two different podcasts, and but you need to get the first hour because I talked at length about the so-called Gospel of Judas. I say so-called because not everything that's called a gospel is a real gospel. That is an authentic account of the life of Christ. We talked about this one being dated at 140. Actually, the copy that they have is dated at 300. It's a translation into the Egyptian language of Coptic from an original that was written in 140, which is 100 years after the time of Christ. If Judas was only 20 years old, that means he'd have been about 120 to 130 years old when he wrote this, which is probably not Judas. That is the author of this. Not everything that says it was written by a biblical character was actually written by a biblical character. So more work will be done on this as time goes on, but those opening comments I think will help you if you're wondering what's all the hubbub about the Gospel of Judas. So that's in our first hour. The second hour we're going to devote mostly to phone calls because we got a lot of them here. So let's go to Dennis. Dennis, welcome to Stand to Reason. Are you in Los Angeles, Dennis?
No, I started out in Brea, but, you know, via cell phone technology and my office.
Okay.
Now in Fullerton. I'm actually calling from the what we call the underground lounge of our church.
Okay, well, the lounge, I meant Los Angeles, greater L.A. area.
There you go.
Okay,
yeah,
gotcha.
Certainly not where your earlier caller was from Singapore.
Sure, okay.
Anyway, I have a book here in my hand called The Present Future by Reggie McNeil.
Okay.
Southern Baptist affiliated, I believe, published just last year, copyright. And my pastor recommended that a number of us here in the church and leadership read this book.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a particularly, as a provocative, disturbing to me statement here, four sentences that Reggie writes, and I'll just read them. It's easier to do that.
What's the title of the book again?
The Present Future.
The Present Future, okay.
And subtitled, Six Tough Questions for the Church.
Okay.
The Bible has become for the modern church the supreme manifestation of the Word of God, not Christ, because it is objective truth, and that's in quotation marks,
mm-hmm.
objective. A modern distinction. That's parentheses. It became the fourth member of the Trinity, the sermon parentheses again, an explanation of text has replaced the Mass along with the mystery of God's intervention. Preaching reflects the new Newtonian world, approaching the text as a body to be dissected into shreds of words and even parts of words, called exegesis. Your thoughts on that?
Well, let's just listen. Let's just take the comment itself. All right. Now, I'm going to take a. I'm going to offer you kind of a modern parable the way I'm working with this. All right. Okay.
Okay.
So we take the sentence. I don't have it all written down. I have a little bit. The present future is the book supreme that we take the scriptures as the supreme manifestation of the Word of God, not Christ. A modern distinction. Now, I could probably take that paragraph that he's offered there and outline it.
By the way, the objective, the it's objective truth that he then puts afterwards, a modern distinction.
Yes, that's right. Oh, yeah, objective truth. That's right. Yeah, I want to get to that in a minute. I'm going to go after this a couple of ways because this is nonsense. Okay, I'm just going to show my hand right off. This is nonsense, and I want to show you why it's nonsense. It's an objection that is ill-informed and it's also foolish. Okay, now I don't know this person, so I'm not making an assessment of this individual. I'm making an assessment of this way of thinking. Okay, it's foolish because of this. I can take that whole statement, and indeed I could take the whole book, and I could outline the book, and I could break it down into its main points. In fact, I suspect that this author, Reggie McNeil, had to do that from the beginning to write the book. He kind of had a general outline how it was going to go, and then he filled in the blanks, so to speak. He fleshed it out. But if we wanted to trim it down and we say, well, what's Reggie really saying? We could say, well, he's saying like three things here. He's making three different points. One, two, three. Now, what do these – first of all, what do these points actually represent?
What do they represent?
Yeah, what he's written. What do they represent?
Well, they're certainly his commentary.
Okay, his commentary. In other words, they're his commentary. They represent his thinking, his thoughts, his point of view. If we understand these words accurately, then we are taking these words, we are understanding concepts that are in Reggie's mind itself. These are his words.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Correct.
If we take these seriously as Reggie's words, as Reggie's ideas, have we objectified these words and put them outside of Reggie in some sense and given them a life of their own?
No.
No, we're just acknowledging that these are tokens or representations of ideas that he has in his mind. And if we wanted to get a clearer idea on what Reggie means so that we can understand Reggie, the thoughts that Reggie himself owns, we might outline it or pick at the words or figure out, now, why did he use this word rather than the other? We might, gee, can I borrow this word from theology? We might exegete his words. That is, because we take Reggie's ideas seriously, or at least we're attempting to do, to take his ideas seriously, not to take some scratchings on the paper and idolize them, but to see them as intended to be by Reggie himself, a representation of Reggie's mind.
Yes.
We look at them carefully, maybe outline them, maybe strain a little bit at some of the words so that we are careful not to misrepresent Reggie if we really respect what Reggie says. Now, if we go through that process because we respect Reggie and because we're trying to figure out his mind,
yes.
And then somebody came by and said, holy cow, what are you doing? You're acting as if these things on a piece of paper have anything to do with a person's actual thinking. You are objectifying them into a new being, and you are treating it like a living being because you're asking these questions about these words. You'd think somebody was nuts, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
Isn't this exactly what he's saying when he objects to our treatment of the scriptures in this way? Look, if the scriptures are in fact what they claim to be, the words of God, then by paying attention to the words, it's showing respect to the one who gave it so that we're not trying to make an idol out of words on a page, but we are trying to show respect and give proper respect to the one God, presumably, who offered the words as tokens of his very thoughts. Does that make sense?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
So this kind of way of objecting is silliness. It's just silliness. If God gives his word, if he talks, and we try to take it seriously, then these people say that we are making an idol. It's the fourth member of the Trinity. It's called a straw man doctrine. It isn't our view. It is God himself that's speaking, and he's making his mind known to us. I was just reading this morning, 1 Thessalonians chapter – I'm sorry, 1 Corinthians. Let me get to it quickly. Chapter 2. Okay. For who among men knows the thoughts of a man except the spirit of the man or the mind of the man which is in him? Even so, the thoughts of God no one knows except the Spirit of God. Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we might know the things freely given to us by God, which things we speak not in words taught by human wisdom, but those taught by the Spirit. So it's a very simple thing he's saying. Gee, God has thoughts, right?
Yeah.
How do we know what those thoughts are? He's got to tell us. And when he tells us, his thoughts are converted into words, which words represent his thoughts. That's all. Now, these words, if they accurately represent his thoughts, these are the very words of God himself. If he were talking these words to us verbally rather than having them written down, it would be the words of God. I mean, there's nothing – how else would you take that? So to call – do you see what I'm getting at here? This is why this attack is foolish. The irony is he thinks this is a modernist approach. It is modernist liberals that use the exact same argument against verbal plenary inspiration.
Exactly.
It's modernist liberals who use this argument against verbal plenary inspiration. You're making the word into an idol. No, I'm not. I'm taking it as what it says. It's God's thoughts. That's it. I'm taking it as God's thoughts. I'm not idolizing it. I am accessing the mind of God through the words that God left behind. So this is why this attempt is foolish. Because when you think about what they claim, it sounds all so highfalutin and spiritual and all that, but it's silliness. Because we would never say the same thing about Reggie's own words, right?
Could you give me a piece of practical advice here as far as an approach I might use with my pastor to explain this without making him feel badly since, well...
Well, the best thing to do is just download the MP3 file tomorrow of this show and give him, let him listen to what I had to say and see, because I don't know, this can't be, it's kind of hard to reduce this to a soundbite, it seems to me, and I know that's what you're asking. All I could say is when you take someone's words, I'd say, Pastor, listen, when you tell me something, I take your words as representative of your thoughts if I'm understanding them correctly. For me to do that is not to objectify your words and give them a force or a personality or some kind of authority that they don't have. It's just simply to take them as extensions of you. That's all. Yeah. Your words are your thoughts and your ideas. I'm reacting with you. I do the same thing with the word somebody calls that idolatry. Well, that's silly. What else am I going to do? What other choice is there if God is communicating, if I don't take God's words as if they were God's words? See, what these people are doing is they don't want God's words to be God's words. And this is why he comes up with this other silly objection, that the notion of objective truth is a modern notion. What a bunch of phooey. Okay, and here's what I would – Jesus said, I came to bear witness to the truth. You think this word aletheia in the Greek was invented recently? I want to ask what the word truth – what Reggie McNeil thinks the word truth means. So when he tells his son, are you telling me the truth? What does he mean when he asks that question? What does that word mean? It means that is your statement that you're making with your words, does it fit the world itself? So when you tell me you did your homework, son, and that statement is true, then you should be able to show me a piece of paper which has your finished homework on it, right? This isn't hard. Okay? The idea that this word truth just means that the claim that I make fits the objective world, the world as it is. So is it true that you're talking to me on the show right now?
Yes.
Well, it is if you are. And if you're not, then it isn't. Now, the definition, the clear a clear articulation of this understanding of the word truth. By the way, we all use the word truth this way. This is what we always mean, that our view corresponds to the way the world is. But it was Aristotle who said, if you say that it is, and it is, or you say that it isn't, and it isn't, then that's true. If you say that it isn't, and it is, or if you say that it is, and it isn't, then that's false. That's our common sense variety of understanding, a garden variety definition of the word truth, okay? So you know what another way to describe what that word truth means? It's called objective truth.
Objective.
But the word objective is just a redundancy, because when we say something is true, we mean that our statements fit the objective world as it is. Okay, so Aristotle says this. That's his definition, his way of characterizing it. Now, when was Aristotle? Was he like 1700? 1800?
No.
Was he like Enlightenment? Was he modern?
No.
400 years before Christ. This writing is a ripoff. It implies that the concept of truth in the objective sense is a concept that modernists made up, but it isn't a concept that modernists made up. It's a concept that not only goes back to the first human beings, but 2,400 years ago, we had a guy named Aristotle at least gave us a clear definition of it that we all use now implicitly. When Paul says, I am telling you the truth, I am not lying, what kind of truth do you think he has in mind there? Objective truth. Is he a modernist? Is he an Enlightenment thinker? This is nonsense.
No.
It's just nonsense. The concept of truth has been around for as long as people have been talking about things. And it's always been basically this notion, what we call now objective truth, but that's just a redundancy. All truth, when we talk about it, we mean it in the objective sense, with very rare exceptions. But it's not a modernist notion. But what happens if Jesus says, I came to bear witness to truth, that is the way things really are. Thy word is truth, Jesus says in John 17. In other words, it accurately reflects the way things really are.
Right.
And the concept of truth like that is thick throughout the New Testament. And then you have some Christian, quote unquote, writer who begins to tell you, oh no, that notion of truth is, oh, that's just a modernist invention. Well, really, then what was meant by all the times that that word was used in the New Testament by all the writers? We know what it meant because we can see what they're saying. I'm telling the truth. I'm not lying. Thy word is truth. By the way, what they want to do, this sounds like an emerging church guy, and what emergents want to do is they want to reduce the word truth to Jesus. I am the way, the truth, and the life, John 14:6. So they want to, Jesus is the truth, and that's what he's saying, right? They're an object of truth. They're not into Jesus. I don't know what that means.
In so many words, yeah.
What does it mean to be into Jesus? What does that mean? Does that mean to listen to what he says and take what he says seriously and make sure we understand it correctly by examining it carefully and then employing it into our life? And if we do that, is he telling us the, watch this word, truth? Is he telling us the way it really is, and that's why we should follow him? Do you see how this challenge is so empty, vacuous, shallow, nothing, useless? However, it gets people skeptical of what they consider dogmatic claims about the way the world really is. Listen, I guarantee you this guy is not skeptical about a whole bunch of things that he likes that Jesus says, and he darn well thinks that those things are the truth. Right.
Yes. Oh, yeah. He is that way, too.
Yeah, you can't reduce the message of Christianity to J-E-S-U-S, because Jesus is someone with content. He taught things with content. He did things with content. He offered a way of life that can be expressed in language, which statements are either true or false. This is nonsense. And it's a serious injustice to Christianity. And if this statement that you've isolated is characteristic of his treatment of the important issues pertaining to the church, then his whole work is suspect.
Well, I wouldn't go quite that far, and I haven't finished reading his work.
Okay, well, in my mind, it's suspect if this is the way. What I said is, if this treatment is characteristic of the rest, then his work is suspect. Now, maybe he's got one clunker in there, and this is it. But my suspicion is this is a broad – this is a meta issue, what he understands truth to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to influence the other things he says. So I would – you know, I'd look with a jaundiced eye on everything else. It could be that he's providing something useful, and generally the emergent guys are pretty good at providing a good critique. But this is not an example of that.
Thank you for the affirmation.
Great talking to you, Dennis, and get back to me sometime after you talk to your pastor, okay?
Okay, thank you. God bless.
All the best. See, folks? Sounds so sophisticated, doesn't it? It's just nonsense. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. I'll be back with more of your calls. Stand to Reason has an absolutely unique cruise conference experience for you this fall. Hi, I'm Greg Kokel, and on September 16th, we'll set sail from Boston with Holland American Cruise Line. We'll enjoy the scenery of the New England coastline, the Canadian Maritimes, the St. Lawrence Seaway, Quebec, and Montreal. In addition to the scenery, you'll enjoy the fellowship of other like-minded Christians and a conference program designed for those who want to represent Christ to a world looking for answers to life's toughest questions. And I'll be joined by some very distinguished guest speakers, Dr. J. Wesley Richards from the Acton Institute, national radio talk show host Kirby Anderson from Probe Ministries, and Kurt Swindoll of Cool Strategies, who will MC all of our events. Our plan is to stimulate you with challenging presentations, answer your questions in open forum discussions, and enrich you through interaction and fellowship, all against the backdrop of New England and the Canadian Maritimes in the fall. Come join Stand to Reason and our all-star lineup for a memorable spiritual adventure. Space on board is limited, so get the details from 1-800-2-REASON or visit str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org. I look forward to seeing you on board. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, well, I've got great news for you. After more than a year in development, the brand new Stand to Reason interactive training series on tactics in defending the faith is now available on DVD. Included are 6 one-hour sessions where I train you step-by-step in valuable, easy-to-use, time-tested techniques that keep you in the driver's seat when talking with others. It's perfect for home groups, for Sunday school, for Bible studies, for homeschooling, with interactive discussion questions, role-playing, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, and a leader guide and a 100-page comprehensive workbook that you can reproduce for each member of your group. Now, if you learn best by listening, mentoring CDs are available, but the best combination is to get them both. Then you'll have the DVD training course, the mentoring CDs to listen to in the car or on your iPod, and the comprehensive 100-page workbook. Now, the special pre-order price through the end of the month is $39.95. After that, it'll be $50, so order now. The Tactics DVDs will ship by the end of the month. Go to our website at str.org or call us at 1-800-2 and the word reason. Don't delay. str.org or 1-800-2-REASON.
Great is the Lord, He is holy and just. By His power we trust in His love.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason, helping you get the fat out of your thinking. You can trim down to fight and weight every weekend here on Stand to Reason, Sundays 3 to 5. I sure hope you consider going on our cruise with us. It's September 16th through the 23rd. It's a floating conference, ladies and gentlemen, starting off in Boston, ending up in Montreal, going to the Canadian Maritimes, and we'll have an interview with Kurt Swindoll coming up short in a couple of weeks, where you know he's been to all these harbors, all these ports, and it's unbelievable things. Not even considering what you'll learn in the conference portion of our cruise itself, with Jay Richards and Kirby Anderson and myself as your instructors. But there are tremendous things. Boston Freedom Trail, for example. Is it Bar Harbor or Halifax has the Museum of the Titanic, Halifax. And, of course, we will be in Charlottetown. Is that where Anne of Green Gables is from? And then, of course, Quebec City and Montreal. I mean, it's going to be a great cruise. And I hope you would give some consideration to spending your vacation in the fall with us. Take your summer vacation a couple weeks late. And if you have kids, you can bring them along. And, you know, the teachers allow that as long as they, you know, do some papers or something. And there's lots of great educational opportunities on this cruise. September 16th through the 23rd, Stand to Reason Cruise. If you go to our website at str.org, you can get the details on that. I hope you sign up and be part of that. Let's quickly go back to the phones. Joe, thank you so much for waiting. You've been waiting a long time.
I know.
It's paid off.
You said let's go quickly to the phone. And
yes.
The interesting thing there is I quickly have to leave. I'm like...
Okay, tell me your question. Maybe I'll have a short answer on this.
To at least give something, and then we'll talk maybe next time.
Okay, can you listen on the radio when you leave?
Yeah.
Okay.
It'll take me We spoke last time about Calvinism and how I felt it was unjust, because if you're totally depraved and you can't rise
right
of that, how can you then be punished for being created that way?
Well, we weren't created that way, but anyway, that's a different issue.
Right. No, mm-hmm.
We were born that way, not created that way. There's a difference. But this is
And I enjoyed the conversation.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. It's a tough question, by the way. And this one is also a tough one. Isaiah 7:14.
Yeah, my basic question, and really, I promise I'll call you again, is how mm-hmm. do you understand that to refer to Jesus?
Well, it's the famous verse, "The Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel." Now, I'm reading here from the New American Standard, and the marginal reference says virgin means, pardon me?
Even whether it's a young woman, or technically it's the young woman, just how, without the specifics of how you translate. I'm not interested in Alma if it's a young woman.
Right. Well, I was just giving the background information for the other listeners. The question is, how does this apply to Jesus when it seems to apply to King Ahaz,
right,
who is in the detail here, who is part of the broader context, the historical circumstance. And it turns out that this child is going to something before this child reaches a certain age, God is going to do something in the life of Ahaz. So it seems like this has a direct historical application. And the answer to that is yes, it does. However, and I can't, this is not one I'm going to give you much help on, and others might be better on this one, but there are sometimes verses in the scriptures have dual fulfillments or appear to. That is, you have Elijah is coming, and that's John the Baptist, but Elijah is still coming. So John the Baptist was kind of a fulfillment of that, and then there's still a deeper fulfillment sometime in the future. Apparently, this was viewed as referring not just to the circumstances there, but also to something in the future. And the reason I say that is the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures that were done before the time of Christ, translate this word maiden with the Greek word parthenos, which doesn't mean maiden, it means virgin. That is, there is no ambiguity about the use of that word, and the New Testament authors themselves understood that this was a veiled reference to the birth of Jesus by a virgin. So sometimes we're not going to be able to get from the local context itself, not us at this stage in time, we're going to see this connection that maybe some others saw in the past, and certainly those under the influence of the Spirit writing the Gospels understood and plugged it in. I'm not going to go to this passage as a powerful evidence to a Jewish person that this is referring to Jesus, because he's going to say, well, it doesn't seem to be referring to Jesus at all. I'm going to be using some other passage that might be more compelling. I think it is referring to Jesus, but I say that because the New Testament writers, under the inspiration of the Spirit, saw it. I'm not able to give any independent evidence for it.
Right. Okay. And with this, I'm going to run that parthenos. I'm not a Greek scholar. I admit this up front. I'm actually Jewish. And
okay.
I'm not one who believes. I'm not a Christian. I'm just,
okay. Sure. Well, I'm sympathetic to your concern about this passage.
No. Well, yeah. I was reading I was reading and having a talk with some friends and talking, and we were having a discussion. So
the Septuagint concern, though, is what?
Oh, the Septuagint, when it refers to Dina after she was raped, and it's referring to Dina as a Yalda, as a young girl, it refers to her as the Parthenos, which is the same word for that you're saying, Isaiah 7:14.
Right. So, but you're saying, so it's not unambiguously.
But it's not even virgin, necessarily.
Okay.
Well, and that's a separate debate of whether Alma is a young woman or a virgin. You know.
Well, of course, young women back then were virgins, so, I mean, that's another part of it, presumably. I mean, it was a standard to think of a young woman as a virgin. So I'd go to Psalm 22 and Isaiah 53. I think those are more persuasive to someone like yourself to see a picture there that I think is much clearer and can be identified with Christ and were understood at the time to be messianic and by Jews, even messianic in character. So,
okay. So maybe next time we'll touch on those.
Maybe we can do that, Joe. Thank you for calling. I appreciate that call. Yeah, it's always nice to hear from you. Let's go to Lou. And Lou, welcome to Stand to Reason. I appreciate your waiting. Also,
thanks, Greg. Greg, I was asked a question recently, and just wanted to get your take on this. The question is: does God answer the prayers of those who are unsaved? Is there anything in the New Testament or Old Testament that says that he does not answer the prayers of those who are unsaved?
Well, I used to be pretty hard-nosed about this, and my rationale was simply, well, look at these guys are rebels to God, and so God is not going to – answering prayer is kind of a province of a special relationship, and therefore God isn't going to do this. I don't hold that view anymore, and I'm not sure what it was that changed my thinking. If I ran across some verses that indicated that, I can only think of a couple that might play in here. One is kind of an obvious thing, although some people might consider it not significant because it's kind of a trick in a way. All unbelievers who pray to receive Christ arguably pray as unbelievers to become believers. So God must hear those prayers. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, so that's a possibility. But some would say, well, they probably already believed in their heart. They are believers by the time that they pray the prayer. I don't know. Somebody could argue that way. But here's another one. In the book of Numbers, you have a prophet for hire named Balaam. Do you remember him?
Yes.
Yeah, he's the guy who spoke. The donkey spoke to him?
Right.
Okay. Now, Balaam prayed to God, and God answered him and told him to prophesy on behalf of Israel, not against Israel, which he was hired to do. He was hired to prophesy against Israel. Now, Balaam had prayers answered by God, and he was not a believer. He was a mercenary prophet who didn't seem in any wise faithful to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, though he did say what the Lord tells me to say, I've got to say, because he knew that he was the real – Balaam knew that God – was the real McCoy. And so he said, I can't, you know, if he blesses, I got to bless, you know, and has he spoken, will he not do it? I mean, God's not a man that he should lie or change his mind, is what Balaam said to those who had hired him to curse Israel. So I think that's a specific example of a non-believer talking with God and having prayer with God, and God's responsive to that person, even though he's not a believer. Also, you know, you have in general, you have God, you know, he reigns upon the evil and the righteous alike. There is a prevenient grace or a general grace that he pours out upon the world. And I don't have any strong reasons to say that God that would not entail answering prayers out of an act of mercy by God over one of his creation. Not children in the special intimate sense that I think those who receive Christ are children of God, but still those who are valuable parts of his creation. So I think that children in the broader sense, I don't see any reason why I would say otherwise. So I think God does answer some of the prayers of the non-believers for those reasons.
I would tend to think the same thing, mainly also because if an unsaved person or someone is praying, he's acknowledging God by doing that.
Yeah.
And so doing, I would think there would be some response from God.
Hey, think of a Cornelius. Mm-hmm. There's another one. Go to Cornelius, Acts chapter 10, and you'll see the situation where Cornelius was in prayer, and he gets a vision from God about Peter, and Peter has his own vision, and he goes out to be with Cornelius, and Cornelius is not a believer. We know that because Cornelius becomes a believer at the preaching of Peter. So, but he is a God-fearer, that is, he is pursuing God the best way he knows how. In fact, I think, well, this tells a story. If you go, if I recall right, I'm paging there very quickly, but you can check it out yourself.
Okay.
I think it says that your alms and prayers have been heard by God. Oh, here it is, verse 31, chapter 10. And he said, Cornelius, your prayer has been heard. There you go.
Okay, all right.
That takes care of that, doesn't it?
Pretty much answers it, doesn't it?
That's Acts chapter 10, verse 31. See, there's a new one on me. I knew it, but I didn't know I knew it. We got a whole bunch of callers to go. We got a short amount of time yet, so I'm going to have to go run, Lou, okay?
Okay, thanks very much, Greg.
Yeah, appreciate your call. There it is. See, I didn't know, and now we know. Acts 10:31. Your prayer has been heard. All right, let's go to Leland. And Leland, welcome to Stand to Reason. Hi.
Thank you, Greg. Nice to chat with you.
Thank you. Nice to chat with you, too.
Say, I heard a maxim today in church that I've heard since childhood, and that is that God loves the sinner but hates the sin.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure that I agree with that particular maxim, but
yeah.
I didn't have a fully formed rejoinder. Wondered if you could help me out.
Okay, I call these things pastorisms.
Okay.
They are little pithy statements that are useful to pastors, and I think they are genuinely useful in that they communicate something true, like God can't look on sin would be another one, God turns his back on sin or turned his back on Jesus at the cross. These are all things that have a usefulness in a very limited way, as long as we understand the limits. But if we take them at face value as fully true without qualification, then it gets us into trouble. Like God turns his back on Jesus. Well, wait a minute. Okay, we know that God, that means God pours out his anger on Jesus. Okay, turned his back. God doesn't have a back, so he doesn't turn his back. And Jesus was God, so, you know, how do you get this split in the Godhood? You can't have a split in the Godhood, you know. So, I mean, we realize that the phrase means that there is a – God expresses his just anger towards sin that he lays on his son, but it isn't that he – literally turned his back. Okay. And then, you know, what was the other one I mentioned? Or all sin is sin is another one. Well, yeah, all sin is sin, but it doesn't mean that all sin is just as bad as any other sin. And that's the mistake there. Now, in this particular case, what people are trying to communicate is that though God has a just wrath towards sin, he still is extending love and forgiveness towards the sinner, which is sound. We read in Romans 5 about how while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. How much more,
you know,
then?
That brought up a question in my mind, and that is, what is the attitude of God towards the unsaved person?
Well, I'm going to go to that here.
Okay.
I mean, and it turns out that it's complicated.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm saying with these pastorisms, there is a truth there that we need to hang on to, but we want to be careful we don't take it to a point that communicates error. Because the fact is that even though God loves the sinner enough to take the first step and to rescue that person, greater love has no man than this, than he lay down his life for a friend.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the scripture actually says that God hates sinners. Where do I get that? Psalm chapter 5. Verse 5 and 6, the boastful shall not stand before your eyes. You hate all who do iniquity. You destroy those who speak falsehood. The Lord abhors the man of bloodshed and deceit. It doesn't say he abhors bloodshed and deceit. It says he abhors the man that does this. It doesn't say he hates iniquity, verse 5. He says
right. He
hates those who do iniquity.
Right, it's very personal.
And that's right. Mm-hmm. And in chapter 11, Psalm 11, I think the same thing, verse 5, the Lord tests the righteous and the wicked, and the one who loves violence, his soul hates.
Mm.
Now, these are called deprecatory psalms. It's like David's really mad. And so he is saying these things that are really mad. Well, yeah, maybe he is, but he – and there's other psalms that talks about dashing your young ones against the rocks and stuff like that. But what we can't do is we can't say David is having a bad hair day here, and so, you know, he's just off his nut a little bit, because he's writing under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, expressing something that's true.
Right.
And so now we have this odd situation. God does hate the sinner. By the way, when God punishes, he doesn't punish sin. He punishes the person who committed the sin. If you read in the book of Proverbs, it talks about the things that God hates. It says the feet that run quickly to evil, the hands that shed innocent blood, the tongue that lies. Notice these are body parts.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you can't press this, God loves the sinner but hates the sin, too far. The fact is that God is really mad.
Right. It's Romans, possible to have a disembodied moral action against which God could be angry.
Exactly. He's mad at the people who choose these things. Romans chapter 1, verse 18 and following, you see the same thing. The wrath of God is being revealed. Now, there it says against all ungodliness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. So it looks like he's mad at the ungodliness, but it's clear that he's condemning the men.
Mm-hmm.
It says they are without excuse further down in the passage. So here's the way I take this then. God both hates and loves at the same time. Now, what are you going to do with that?
Hmm.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it may turn out. The tendency is that we think of hate and love as emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's like saying, well, God's getting mad at me with a hateful, spiteful feeling, and he's loving me with a loving feeling at the same time. And that sounds like a contradiction.
Right.
That is a little bit hard to fathom. However, maybe it isn't talking about existential emotions that are happening at the same time. I mean, if you're a father, you could probably think about how you could have really bad feelings and loving feelings about your children at the same time.
Right, of course.
And so maybe the answer to that is in there somewhere. I'm not going to unravel that for you. I have to go to break, but it does give you an idea that this is a pastorism that's true in a limited way, but we don't want to say that God doesn't – he's not mad at people. He's really mad at people, in fact. And I don't want to blunt the force of those verses because what I want to say next is the only place of safety for a God who hates sinners is under the cross of Jesus Christ.
Hmm.
All righty?
Thank you very much, Greg.
Leland, good talking to you.
Bye-bye.
I'm glad you waited. Going to break, 1-800-227-5278. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON. Or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
blessing that you can be born again.
Greg Kokel back here in the waning segment of Stand to Reason. I hate to interrupt Keith Green. He does this so well, doesn't he? But we have people waiting. So, Keith, thank you for your help. It's beautiful. Maybe we'll listen to this next week or something, Easter. Let's see. Back to the phones then. And Scott, thank you for calling from Illinois. Scott. Oops, sorry. Hold on just a minute. I hit the wrong button. Make that Scott from the great state of Illinois.
That's right.
Yes, sir. Where in Illinois are you from?
Near Peoria.
Okay.
Downstate from, I know you were from up north.
Right.
North from
Illinois, Illinois. Is Illinois State, no, that Illinois State University is in Normal.
Right.
Okay, yep. Peoria, okay. But
home of the Bradley Braves.
Okay. Scott, thank you for calling.
Thank you. Just had a quick question. On. Just wondered what your views were on divorce among Christians. When by your view it's permissible, Scripture, you know, seems to be at first brush seems to be a little bit ambiguous on the subject, and I recently had a conversation with a minister that believes that divorce is justifiable in circumstances such as not only in circumstances such as adultery, but also in like domestic abuse type cases.
Yeah.
And Scripture, you know, doesn't come right out and say that. I mean, I would think in principle that that seems like a good idea, but you know, since Scripture doesn't come right out.
Yeah, let me respond to that. The two obvious ones, I think, are Jesus' comments about marriage. First of all, made it clear that divorce is not something that should happen very often. And in fact, when Jesus gave his opinion, the disciples were so flabbergasted. They said, boy, maybe we should never get married then if it's going to be that strict.
Right.
So if one's view is not pretty strict, you probably don't have the view of Jesus. But he said you don't – if you marry and divorce other than for unchastity, you've forced your wife to commit adultery. So that seems to be – and in the case of unchastity, adultery has already been committed. So that seems to be one example of when a divorce would be justified. In 1 Corinthians 7, Paul discusses a circumstance when between believer when a believer is married to a non-believer and the non-believer abandons the believer, and this happened sometime back then when believers – not when believers married non-believers. I don't think that happened very much. Not then, does now. But when non-believers became believers, and then they were married to a non-believer, and maybe the spouse wasn't happy about that and decided to split. And Paul says, you know, you're called to peace. You're not under obligation there. Now, I take that to mean that the person then who is the injured party, the believer who had been abandoned, is now free to remarry, okay? Now, you've raised another issue, and so let me go at this other issue, like another possible exception, and let me go this way. And of course, I'm not sure exactly how you're going to answer here, but maybe you won't agree with me even on this point, but then it won't be useful to argue this way, but let me try it. Does the Bible teach that we should not lie?
Yes.
Does it ever tell us to lie?
No.
Are there times when lying is the right thing to do?
It would seem that way.
Yes. In fact, I can think of two occasions in the Bible where people lied and it was the right thing to do and they were applauded for that.
Right.
Rahab is one example. So what this shows us then that the Bible seems to be – it's not a contradiction, but rather there is a moral point of view that it seems to be implied in the Scripture, which is called moral absolutes, but they're graded. That means some moral absolutes are more important than other moral absolutes, and there are times when you are put in a position – where you have to choose one or the other. In isolation, in a moral dilemma like this, either one would be wrong, but when you're put in this position, you have to choose the best good in the circumstance. So that's why if you have a chance to save a life, but the only way to save a life is to tell a lie, you're morally obliged to save the life. So you have these moral so even though the Scriptures are not saying, okay, under this circumstance and this circumstance – you can get a divorce, implicit is the fact that there are going to be moral dilemmas where you're in conflict there, and then you're obliged to do the greater good.
Right.
And so if Jesus, if you have these two examples, well, these are clear examples where it's okay, at least arguably, to get a divorce. Well, what about other circumstances where a divorce is the less of two unavoidable evils? Well, then I think you got to do the lesser of the two evils, or would probably be more appropriate is to call it the greater of two goods. And that would be a case if children are in jeopardy, if their lives are in jeopardy, or the spouse is being abused. I think that harm to the children or to the spouse is a greater moral concern than the sanctity of that marriage.
Right.
And so it is arguably, at least, the case, and I don't know, there's some debate as to when you cross that line, but arguably that you can get to a point where the danger is such that it is the right thing to do to remove oneself or one's children from that imminent danger by getting a divorce.
Yeah. And I understand what you're saying. Then what you're talking about, you know, where to draw the line is tough. And then it almost, I hate to use the term, but it almost becomes relativistic, because then you want to argue, well, you know, where is that?
Yeah, okay. Well, let me just clarification on that word relativism, because that's a response that people often offer here. Now, keep in mind, I wrote a book on relativism. Okay,
I read it.
So so I'm going to give you an accurate or precise definition. It is not relativistic when your moral decisions are relative to the circumstances. Because, in fact, when you think about it, all moral decisions must be relative to the circumstances. That is, you have to take into consideration the relevant factors of each circumstance to know which moral rule is in play in that set of circumstances. Okay, relativism isn't when your moral answers are relative to the circumstances. It is when your moral answers are relative to the individual.
I see.
Okay.
Well, that's great. I appreciate that.
To see the difference. So the truth maker in objective truth or objective morality is the circumstances. The truth maker in relativism is the subject, not the object.
Yeah, no, that's understandable.
Okay.
And then quickly, remarriage after a situation like that?
Well, it seems to me if you have a legitimate, bona fide, morally acceptable reason for the divorce, there should be no limitations to remarrying. If you don't have, then I think there's a problem. And that's one of the toughest things to deal with.
Right, and maybe it's not good in this kind of format to give a good full response.
Well, it's just that it's not so much the format. It's just that I'm running out of wisdom. This is one of the hardest things to answer. I cringe when people ask questions about divorce because I don't know that I'm well qualified to answer that. It seems that Jesus and Paul would be 1 Corinthians 7. Their standards are quite rigorous, which means that we ought to all practice what my pastor said for many years, Pastor Zach, my former pastor, and that was marry wisely, marry well, because you get one ticket. And nobody plans to get divorced when they get married, but for a lot of people, their value system easily entails divorce. And we'd be much better off if we'd eliminate that option from our value system.
Right.
And this is why Paul says, look, if you have two believers that aren't getting along, 1 Corinthians 7, and they separate, and he says you should, all right, be separated, but don't get remarried. Work it out. Be reconciled is the point that he's making. So anyway, that's the principle.
Yeah, I appreciate your time.
Okay, good talking to you, Scott from Illinois. And we've got time to go to Kurt from Tucson. Kurt, welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg, how you doing?
Good, thank you.
I had a question here.
How are you?
Is there going to be free will in heaven?
What do you mean by that? Not by heaven, but by free will.
Will the people who are there be able to sin in heaven?
You can have free will without the ability to sin, by the way.
Pardon?
The reason I asked the question that I did is because it seems to me you could have free will without the ability to sin. Is God free?
Is God free?
Yeah. Does he have free will?
Does God have free will?
Yeah.
I would think so. Yeah,
okay. Can he sin?
Most the definition that Christians use is that it would be against his nature to sin, so therefore he wouldn't be able to. But humans do have that nature. So.
Yeah, but let me. I want to get some things. We've got to get some things in place here to answer the question. And I asked the question that I did to help people understand something about the nature of moral freedom, or at least of free will.
Okay.
I'll set moral freedom aside for the moment because that's a species of freedom, it seems to me. If God is free, in a meaningful sense of freedom, and God can't sin, then it's possible to be the kind of creature who, for whom it is capable to sin but still be free. God's an example. Therefore, if we're in heaven and we are made such that we cannot sin, that doesn't mean we've lost our freedom.
Okay.
Do you see that?
But that goes against, then, the argument when people ask, why did God create evil in the first place? The answer is, well, he gave us a choice because love would be meaningless if there wasn't a choice between at least two options.
Well, with this, well...
He could have bypassed...
No, you're right. In general, I agree with your point.
Straight to heaven. Pardon.
Yes. In general, I agree with the point you just made. I think you're right. I mean, I'd strain it a couple of words, you know, because certainly God didn't create evil. I mean, that was what you said early. And God didn't create evil, first of all. And secondly, he allowed evil. And some people offer, well, why is evil possible? Because love isn't possible without the possibility of evil and rejection. I'm with you then if you are rejecting that argument. I don't think that's a good argument because that would make love impossible in heaven if heaven is a place of moral perfection, which is morally perfect, perfect of necessity and not just, in a sense, accidentally because we just decide not to sin there. I don't think we're going to be capable of sinning there because we will have resurrection bodies. We will be like him. We will see him as he is. The flesh will be gone. The fallen nature will be gone. We will be glorified in moral perfection and have the kinds of natures that never desire to sin. We will share in God's holiness in that regard. It's a communicable attribute. We will be like him in that regard. And therefore, we will not be. It's not native holiness. It is a change that God makes, so that we are now immutably good. And we will, as such, since now it's our nature to be good, we will not be able to choose evil. We can choose whatever we want. So we will have choices. We can choose this or this or this or this or this. We will have the ability to do otherwise. And that's what a lot of people consider a relevant feature of choice. We could do otherwise in a full range of things, but not otherwise if that means we could rebel against God and sin. We will be able to do anything we want, and we will never want to do anything wrong, just like God does what he wants, and he never wants to do anything evil. It's not in his nature to do so. It will be impossible for both God and us to do wrong in that circumstance. How's that? Does that make sense?
That's okay. And one other thing that ties into this,
Initially,
when God created heaven in the first place, and he had the angels, and then I assume that it was perfect at that point. But then, still, Satan and his angels decided to be prideful.
Yes, it was perfect, but
God says that we will be like the angels in heaven. So,
in that sense, Jesus says we will be like angels, he means specifically we won't be reproducing. That was the point he was making there. I don't think that's my true proof text for righteousness, but other texts seem to indicate that. But I think you're on the right track there. Thanks for the call, Kurt, from Tucson, and that's it for the show. Go to our website, str.org, and go to the podcasting section if you're a listener, and sign up for Frapper, that is, put your name on the map. Then we'll draw this week, and maybe we'll choose your name and send you some free product for Stand to Reason. We'd like to know who you are, though. We want to expand our community and know where you're at. Okay, that's it for today, friends. I'll see you next time. In the meantime, be a good ambassador for Christ. Knowledge, wisdom, character. And tell them Greg sent you. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Go out and give them heaven this week, friends. Bye-bye.